comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors. Hi, folks. Welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. It is talk radio like nowhere else on Earth, and it is the show where you matter. Now, speaking of you matter, let's talk about the website. It has sent veritable ripples around the world. That when you type in kevinsmithshow.com, you don't get the website. Now, that is a temporary condition. It is out of my control. We were not hacked. And the explanation for what happened was put into a special message, two special messages that went out to people who are subscribed to the K-Files e-zine. Now, all around the world, there are people sending me emails. And they're bouncing back because kevinsmithshow.com is not active right now. And they're frantic. And I'm getting telephone calls where people are leaving me messages saying, you know, what happened? Are you off the air? You're not broadcasting anymore? What's up? All of those are people who hear me night after night after night after night say, subscribe to the K-Files, then you won't be in the dark. And they just didn't do it. Now, since they didn't subscribe to the K-Files, I don't have their email addresses. I have the capability of emailing out. I can't receive email in. And so what we did is we composed a couple of, one yesterday, one today, emails to everyone that's on our K-Files list and informed you so that you're not in the dark and you're here and you're listening to the show or you're watching the show right now on this backup page. You're able to watch the show even if you're not a member. But normally that's in our members area. And it will be again before the week is out. So anyway, I want to congratulate all of you for deciding to move from the land of the mushrooms and to move into the land of those who know by subscribing to the K-Files. You see, it is important, isn't it? Anytime anything strange or any kind of hurdle we have to leap, anytime that comes up, we are able to inform the K-File subscribers. And then everyone else who hears me night after night after night and they sit on their thumb and don't do it, they don't subscribe, they're just in the dark and I'm sorry for them, but, you know, it's kind of like when you tell someone don't jump off that 40-story building, don't jump, don't jump. If they jump, they splat. And we say, subscribe, subscribe, subscribe. It's free. Then you'll be in the know. And they don't subscribe, and then they're in the dark, and then they can't be here to hear the show. Well, sorry. We tried. We'll be back with Walter Bosley right after this. We'll be right back. My guest this evening is Walter Bosley. Most of you are very, very familiar with Walter Bosley. You know him well. And you know him as a former U.S. Air Force OSI special agent. You know him as a counterintelligence expert. You know him as a writer, a publisher. And he's been on the show quite a number of times. And we're always delighted to have him back with us. And the last time he was on the show, he shared with us, I called it a prediction, and he said that his source called it a calculated estimate, not a prediction. And the source, and I will use the word prediction because it's shorthand and it's a lot easier than saying calculated estimate, predicted that there was going to be on February 23rd a major earthquake in a Northern California city. Walter, welcome back to the show.
Well, hey, I'm glad to be back. Thanks for having me, as usual.
Well, Walter, you had sent me the calculated estimate or something. I'm assuming that's what it is, and you put it in an envelope, sent it to me in the mail, and I'm going to open it now. And the source has communicated to you, I understand, that he does not wish for his name to be used, and he didn't in the beginning. He just, based on some calculations that he had made, determined that he thought it was, there was going to be this earthquake. All right. Now I've just opened it and I'm going to read what we have here minus his name. You've dated this on, 9th of January, 2010. On this date, the source contacted Walter Bosley to inform him of a calculated prediction involving recent earthquake activity in California. According to the source, the city of San Francisco will be struck by an earthquake of disastrous magnitude that will destroy much of the city. As a result of his calculations, the source fears this cataclysmic earthquake will hit the city on Tuesday, 23 February 2010. Walter Bosley states that said earthquake striking 24 hours on either side of the source's predicted date should be considered an accurate hit. Walter Bosley contacted Kevin Smith on Monday, January 11, 2010, and the two agreed to verify this prediction by recording it in a sealed envelope in advance of the date. We would like to emphasize that the source's method involved calculations of numbers as well as intuitive experiences, and then it is signed Walter Bosley. Have I accurately read this, Walter?
Yes. Yeah. That is indeed what it said, and what the estimation or prediction.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I find it interesting because we all know that 23 February came and went, 22 February came, went, 23 came and went, 24 came and went, and San Francisco is still standing. But what I find interesting, and so did a lot of listeners because I've gotten email to this effect, is that instead of the earthquake being San Francisco, we had Haiti, we had Japan, we had Chile, we've had Taiwan, where else? Turkey. But it all started right about that time. Missed it a little bit, but it all started at right about that time. What do you make of all this?
Well, first of all, I just want to say our connection is such that I'm only getting about half your words, but I think that what's interesting about this is that the source was obviously wow, you know, in line with activity in a general way, absolutely, because of what has happened, just as you've outlined. I think that this, and the source no longer wishes to comment on this anymore, but I think we can look at this and say, well, probably what, you know, the source predicted is inevitable, that it will, you know, happen as predicted, which means, you know, Northern California is not out of the woods yet.
Well, you know, California, a big portion of California, is not on the North American tectonic plate. It's on the Pacific plate. And the reason that it's our western coast is because the Pacific plate pushed it up against the North American plate. And if it pushed that direction, it seems logical to me that at some point it will retract.
I didn't get any of that. Sorry.
All right. Well, are you on a cordless phone?
I'm on a landline with a cord and everything.
That is odd. All right. Tell you what, we're not going to fight that. I'm going to hang up, and we're going to call you on another phone system.
All righty.
Yeah, there's no reason to, no reason at all to fight that. All right, tell you what we'll do. We'll just play a little music and be right back. We're back. We've got him on the other line now. And, Walter, can you hear me better now?
Clear as a bell. Much better.
Okay. What I said is that California is not even on the North American plate. And in fact, a part of it is, but the major portion of it is sitting on the Pacific tectonic plate.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it's the western coast of the United States of America is because the Pacific plate has pushed up against the North American plate. It seems to me then that at some point that is going to rebound and it's going to begin moving away from North America at some point. And if it does, then that carries California, a big portion of California, with it. Now, does that make sense so far?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Having said that, there are some very ancient maps that show California as an island. Is it possible that at one point it was not pushed all the way up against our western coast and somebody saw it?
Very much possible, because the farther you go back into the history of what was known and believed about California, the earliest sources, indeed, you had they weren't connected. That was considered almost a large chain of very large islands. And there's the native history talks about an inland sea in the era after that. So it was as if the plate was pushed kind of back in place by activity, and the waters, you know, eventually dissipated. Certainly, when you go into the desert areas, particularly near the fault lines, you know, you realize you're looking at an old seabed, particularly out in Death Valley and such places. So, yeah, it makes sense. It fits with the lore and the history.
All right, now, let's say that were to happen. Wouldn't that be the big one?
Oh, yes. Yes. Absolutely.
Now, the San Andreas Fault is certainly not the only fault line in California. California is fractured with fault lines.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you suspect that is?
Well, just, you know, my knowledge, it's just the basic nature of, you know, these plate tectonics. It's because this piece of land happens to straddle two plates. It's just the luck of the draw, the nature of the beast, whatever you want to call it. I think naturally where two plates meet, you know, the edges are going to be a lot more fragile. It's just the way it is.
All right. Now, does that cause, this is where I was headed with the question, because, you know, you've talked to us a whole lot about ley lines, and you've written about ley lines. Okay, so let's talk about that. Does this arrangement where California is basically sitting on the Pacific plate, a big chunk of it is, and it's just pushed up against the North American plate, and perhaps that pushing has caused these fractures and faults? Maybe not. I don't know what's caused them. But does that have anything to do with the ley lines? Now, here's the rest of the question. The reason I ask that is if California were to pull away and resume its status as a big island out there, which lore says it was, if it were to do that, would the existing fault lines still be there, even though there would be water covering them?
I would think in the areas where the land did not literally split apart, and then again, what is where the land splits apart but essentially a fault line, in essence. So, mm-hmm. You know, the answer is yes, it might be a wide gaping area, you know, which of course fills with water, which is what will happen.
Is the fault line still there? It's just underwater? Is that what happens to it?
Not the
fault line, I mean the ley line.
Oh, the ley line. Yes, see the ley lines, here's the thing. The ley lines, as we call them, it's actually the ley energy. And what the ley energy does is it flows through two features. Number one, the world grid, okay, which is more of a uniform horizontal, vertical, you know, series of lines. But this energy also, when it flows through these, it spreads across the terrain and it follows the curvy linear lines. It follows, and while it follows the terrain, it can also, during certain periods of formation of a planet, form those lines. If you get my meaning, you've got a grid, and you turn that grid on, and it's like the charge is running through. Let's say the grid is like a mesh of wire around a ball, okay?
Okay.
And it's connected to a power source. You turn it on, the power source runs through that wire frame, but what it also does is it runs off of that wire frame and kind of spreads out over the surface of the ball. Now, if the ball has distinct textural features, then that energy running through the grid wires and flowing, you know, emanating off of the grid wires is going to follow those textured features of the ball's surface. Now, that's how it is with the Earth. You've got essentially a wire grid, so to speak, that is the world grid system, the energy running through those horizontal and vertical lines that surround the globe, but they emanate from those lines off of them and go out over the terrain, mostly gathering along the features of terrain like mountain ridges and fault lines and things like that, if you follow my meaning. And during certain, say, for instance, in volcanic areas where the land is more fluid, it can, you know, it can form the actual features. Once the features are formed, then the energy follows those formed features. So I want to answer that yes, based on my knowledge, yes, the energy would indeed, the lay energy would indeed continue to run through those faults, underwater or not.
Okay, now I'm going to broadside you. I don't think I've ever done that, but I'm going to, and I'm going to do it on purpose, because we're talking about ley lines and ancient history, and I know this is something you've studied a lot. Walter, there are a lot of people who think that California is a huge chunk of Lemuria.
Yes.
There are people who have written things about ancient tunnels in California, and even in the Los Angeles area, ancient tunnel systems still being used by the remnants of the Lemurians. Have you heard anything about that?
I've heard a lot about that.
Let's talk about it. What do you know about it?
Well, basically, that's a whole. What I know about it is, you know, that's a wide gamut of the general lore that's out there. And I will tell you how it specifically relates to California. I lean towards believing what you said, that in California there is evidence, if you know how to look for it, that whatever the ancient civilization of Lemuria was, it extended to the western United States, and there remain remnants of it that you can find and see in the state of California. That is talked about in detail in Sechery's handprint of Atlas, which has been revised for this year and is available at, as a Kindle book right now on Amazon.com, and will be available as a print-on-demand book by the end of this month. And you can read all about it in there. And I touch on it in my research for my new book, Empire of Pan, which is going to be coming out probably this year.
All right. We have to step away for a break, and when we come back from this break, I want to go explore Lemuria just a little bit. We'll be back, folks. Don't go away. Talking with Walter Bosley. Walter, we'll pick up in just a moment where we left off. Just a quick reminder, though, folks, if you are in driving range of Tucson, Arizona, I'll be speaking at the Tucson MUFON meeting on this Saturday. It's at 1 o'clock, and it's at the Valdez Library. Okay. So I'd love to see you and love to meet you personally if you're within driving range of Tucson. All right, Walter Lemuria.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you said you know quite a bit about it from the lore, and you said there are artifacts of Lemuria scattered around California.
Yeah.
Give us an example or two of some of the artifacts of Lemuria that are scattered around California.
Well, again, I referred to Sechery. He's by no means the only person who's discussed this in writing, but there's an area in California called Point Mugu, M-U-G-U. There's a, I believe, a Coast Guard station and some naval presence there, but that's what it's known for by a lot of people. And but also, there is kind of a state park area there, and in some areas of that park, it has been demonstrated by some writers and researchers that there are remnants of giant stone heads. And after the next break, I'm going to get you the name of the researcher, because I, off the top of my head, I don't know it. I know that Sesheri talks about it in his book, but I'm going to get you the name of this researcher so that you know who I'm talking about and can go to directly to his stuff. But it's very interesting. The heads, when they're pointed out, they resemble very much almost kind of an Indonesian style of artwork.
They're not like Easter Island?
They're not like what?
Easter Island?
No. They are more interestingly like Indonesian or Balinese or in some cases Hindu, East Indian. It's a very interesting. And also, some feel that if you're familiar with Pyramid Lake up in Nevada, where it sets right on the California-Nevada border, some feel that that feature itself is artificial. Very similar to the pyramidal rock features you and I saw on South Mountain, interestingly enough. Which, you know, when things get so old, sometimes they can be in such a state of deterioration that they superficially appear natural, but indeed, you know, upon closer inspection, may not be. And these are just some. Now, if you look at the lore, if you go back to the Chumash Indians, which I got into in my research, and I discuss a little bit in the upcoming book, Empire of Pan, the Chumash, their most ancient beliefs date back to things that, like for instance, an ocean, you know, we're talking pre-Spanish exploration, pre-Spanish conquest, as it were. The farther it goes back, they were an ocean-going, a seafaring culture. Well, you know, we usually don't think of our, you know, North American natives, particularly in California, as being seafaring, but they indeed, the farther you go back, they indeed were, and they still, to this day, the Chumash, they have a kind of a veneration ceremony which involves something called a tomol, or a pearl canoe, and it is almost identical to canoes found in the South Pacific Islands among those cultures, and it's just, you know, there's all sorts of little clues, and I was very surprised, you know, the deeper I went into this in my research, you know, the more I found that convinced me that there is likely some sort of what we would call Lemurian influence there, remnant, you know, whatever that civilization was, I do believe it was there.
Okay, now, one of the stories that's been out for a long time, when the internet was in its infancy, this story appeared on the internet. And I know because I found it, and I copied it, and I printed it out. And this is many years ago. So I know maybe that's the first time it got published, but I know that it's been out since the early 80s. Now, the story is that there was a work crew doing some excavations in the Los Angeles area. And the story tells where, but I don't remember, and I've moved several times and to several different countries since then. So I no longer have, or if I do have it, I don't know where it is, the printout. But somewhere in the Los Angeles area, and they were doing some excavation to get ready to build a building, and they dug into a tunnel. Mm-hmm. And when they heard noises coming from this tunnel, and they went in to examine and found that there were some very tall reptilian type beings living in that tunnel, or at least occupying the tunnel at the time it was dug into.
Right.
Have you heard that story?
I've heard that story.
Tell me about it. What do you know about it?
I pretty much what I know about it is basically what you just said. it is interesting that it's been around actually for decades, like you said, and even it I believe it dates back to the 1950s, which makes it, to me, that's what makes it most interesting, because the reptilian theme really kicked off in our times, really in the last 20 years or so. But there we have this story dating back, I believe, to the 1950s. And maybe that was the origin of the whole reptilian thing. But I just... I, believe it or not, there's all sorts of other things you've heard me talk about, but this one I kind of take with a grain of salt. I am not surprised that they would have found an underground tunnel. I'm absolutely not surprised at all. And it wouldn't surprise me that they indeed found something that was probably pretty shocking to their basic perception of what the world and history are. But beyond that, I've never really seen anything that convinced me that was anything but maybe, kind of an exaggerated tale. But then again, I don't know for sure. But in its defense, the one thing in its defense is that it does, I believe, date back to the 1950s before, the reptilian thing was a big theme as it is now. So, maybe there indeed is something to it.
Well... I have a theory about things.
Mm-hmm.
It may be accurate, it may not be, but we can test it and see. And here's the theory. People cannot draw what they haven't seen. If they have not, at least in some variation, seen it, they can't draw it, mm-hmm. and they can't make a sculpture of it. And we'll test that in just a minute with our listeners. And listeners, I invite you to get a pen and paper or a pencil and paper, because I'm going to ask you to do an experiment with me. But if you go back to the Sumerian culture, which is the oldest known city-dwelling civilization on the planet.
Yes.
Now, it may not be the oldest. It's the oldest one we know.
Right, and yes, I'm familiar with where you're going.
Okay, now they have little sculptures that they did. Some of them are big sculptures, but they have some little ones, and of their gods. Now, Sumerians had a very distinctive appearance. We know because they did sculptures of themselves. And they did not look at all like their gods. Their gods, many of them, had what we today would call European features. The Sumerians did not. Okay. And we would call it European features, not because these were Europeans. Europe as a political bloc didn't exist. Okay. But they had features that they could come into the United States, Canada, the UK, all over Europe and Australia
mm-hmm.
today.
Mm-hmm.
And we would just say, okay, they look like us. But they had some that had distinctively reptilian features. And they have a little goddess carved that is very distinctively reptilian, and she's holding a little reptilian baby in her arms.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now the question is, how did they know to draw that? You can't draw what you've never seen. All right, now, I'm going to give you another little bit. If you leave Sumeria and travel from Sumeria, which is basically, it is modern-day Iraq, but travel over to Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia, the southernmost province of the former Yugoslavia, of Serbia, the southernmost province is called Kosovo. The capital of Kosovo is Pristina, and in the museum in Pristina, Kosovo, there is a terracotta carved head, and it's like a mask, and it's reptilian. Mm-hmm. It looks just like the thing from Sumeria. Here is the experiment, folks. Have you got your paper and your pen ready? Have you got or your pencil? Pencil's fine. Hey, if you need a crayon instead, use a crayon. It's okay. All right? Anything to draw with. And you may be artistic. You may not be artistic, but it doesn't matter. Okay? What I want you to do is draw a bog doggy. I'll wait. Draw a picture of a bog doggy. Have you got your bog doggy drawn yet? You can't draw one, can you? You know why you can't draw one? Because you've never seen one. You don't know what it is. So people who carve these things have seen these things. Maybe what they've carved is accurate, and maybe it's not as accurate as a real modern trained sculptor would have done. Nevertheless, they are giving you in stone their version of a videotape. They're giving you in stone, their carving is their version of a photograph. That means it must, you can't draw what you've never seen. You know why we can do reptilians? Because they did reptilians. That's why we can draw them, because they drew them. But go all the way back to the first guy that drew one, that carved one. How, if you never saw it? We'll be back right after this. Those of you who did draw a bog doggy, I would like for you to attach it to an email and send it to me. Now, you can, as you know, because you're subscribed to the K-Files, or most of you are, you know the address to send it to. The temporary email address is kevinsmithshow@yahoo.com. We're using that right now when the site is back up, hopefully tomorrow. It was supposed to be back up yesterday. But, and then they promised all day today. I was with them twice today, asking questions and taking them to school. But then they promised it would be up today, and it wasn't. So maybe tomorrow we'll see. But when the site comes back up, we go back to using the contact page, okay? But right now, if you drew a bog doggy, attach it to an email, send it to me, and I'll choose the best one and show them on our TV channel. Walter, did you draw a bog doggy?
I probably cheated because I've already seen what you're talking about. So,
okay, you see the point. The point is, someone had to be the first one to see a reptilian in order to have created a reptilian structure, sculpture, you see. Somebody had to have seen one. And then all other reptilians that have been drawn, modeled, sculpted since then, you could say, well, whoever did this drawing of a reptilian got the idea from that ancient Sumerian clay statue. Okay, maybe they did. Maybe not. Maybe they saw a reptilian, but maybe they did. Maybe they got it from that. The point is, where did that guy get it from? The first one. They had to have seen it.
Right.
All right. Now, how does that relate to California and Lemuria? This story that came from the 1950s about the crew digging into the construction crew, digging into a tunnel system and finding that there were reptilian beings in there. It is possible that these construction guys had seen these carvings from Sumeria, but in 1950, I doubt it. Most of them, who knew of Sumeria in 1950? Nobody except college professors and only a few of them.
Right. It's very interesting that, like I said, that this was seen in 1950, and that would provide the bona fides for this story. When you read the story, just read the event, you kind of, with a 2010 view, you kind of go, "Oh, that's just not believable. That sounds like something, you know, that was made up, and you know, in the reptilian craze, if you want to call it that." But yes, indeed, you bring up a very good point. The fact that it was 1950, this was not really out there in a popular concept. And the ancient Sumerian gods, I would like to throw in that this statuary I'm talking about that was at Point Magoo, by the way, that researcher's name is Robert Stanley, I believe, was the first one to really look into this and write about it extensively. But Sesheri and the Handprint of Atlas has a couple of drawings of what's called Balanced Rock, which is in the Santa Monica Mountains. And when you look at this thing, you can see an eye and an ear. Now, it's a 60-foot tall rock, okay, and it's severely corroded over the ages, but you can see an eye and an ear in the style of the ancient Hindu or ancient, you know, Balinese, Indonesian style sculpture. And what's interesting is this particular head that he features, this giant 60-foot tall stone head, the local natives referred to as their helmeted serpent god. And I believe that's where Stanley got his description, is from ancient natives' description of this thing being some type of serpent god. And so, you know, there we have tunnels underground in L.A., and they claim to see reptilian men, and here we have this, what is supposed to be an ancient serpent god's head, carved right there just to the west, a little northwest of Los Angeles. So, you know, maybe indeed there is something to this story, and maybe that's where they went, is underground. I would like to throw out there, if you recall, I talked about a novel I had written in the early 90s. I think I've talked about it on the show, that I was told not to publish.
Yes.
Because it had some... Yes. Well, one of the features in there I had it was I had an FBI surveillance guy assigned to surveil what they knew to be an extraterrestrial. Well, he follows this humanoid extraterrestrial that looks very human, looks as human as you and I, throughout the whole story, and in the end, this extraterrestrial confronts him and reveals that he's not the extraterrestrial. He reveals that we are the extraterrestrials, and he reveals that he is a product of evolution from the dinosaurs, in effect making him a reptilian, so to speak. And that was one of the things in this novel that I was told not to publish because there was too much truth in it.
All right. Now, and because you brought that up, I think we need to go over that just a moment about the novel and what you were told and kind of who told you. But let me tack this on to what you just said. I saw a documentary years ago where they got forensic artists to do the evolution of a dinosaur over, just keep evolving the dinosaur over millions of years beyond, you know, they say that the dinosaurs vanished 65 million years ago. Okay, so let's just keep evolving them as if they didn't vanish. And what would you come up with? And what they came up with was an upright bipedal reptilian that in every way looks humanoid, but he's a reptile. And he's upright, he's standing, you know. And a lot of people have seen that and will remember that documentary. But tell us about this novel and who told you and why.
Well, this was something I had written a little short screenplay in 1986, and then I decided to expand it into a novel. And it was about two main characters. One is an Air Force officer, the other one is an FBI agent. They both are covertly employed by an organization called Space Command, and it is the secret United States space program. And this is something I wrote in 91 when, you know, I was reading about, you know, similar all the ideas that were out there in the 80s, and I put this together. And in the novel, the storyline with the FBI agent is that he's surveilling this man who's supposed to be an extraterrestrial human, and all through the story, meeting with human beings, usually it was my way to poke fun at the New Age folks, which I still love to do. And the pilot, actually, who was an astronaut for the covert space program, he disappeared in the first faster-than-light-speed spacecraft. He disappears and then reappears in the hollow of the Earth, which is revealed at the end. It's revealed at the end that the Earth is hollow. So you can see all the lore that I put together. And, you know, I thought this was a big, fantastic sci-fi, spy adventure kind of thing, and all these concepts were pretty out there and you know, such. And I was told at the time, I finished it in 91, by a professional mentor, someone who'd been in the biz for years, to not try and get that published, because being an FBI employee at the time, I had to have everything approved by headquarters. And it was purely science fiction. I mean, that's how I was presenting it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told not to attempt to get this published because I did not want my bosses to know how much I knew, because there was too much in the book that was true. And it involved going to Mars and the fact that the face on Mars is the characters were able to communicate from the face on Mars to the Sphinx in Egypt by speaking into these objects. In other words, a man, the FBI agent was on Mars, and he spoke into the face on Sidonia, and his boss was standing before the Sphinx in Egypt and hearing what the agent was saying from Mars. You know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And
so this was a novel, and you say a professional mentor who had been in the biz. When we come back, I want to find out what biz he had been in. We'll be back. Don't go away, folks. Welcome back. My guest this evening is Walter Bosley. In a moment, we're going to open up the telephone lines. They're not open yet. And when we do open up the telephone lines, I will give you the telephone numbers. Normally, for people who live outside of the USA and outside of Canada, we have the flash message option. Well, that doesn't work right now because of all the weird stuff over at the site. And we are, if you are on my site right now, you're not at kevinsmithshow.com. You're at a completely different server in another part of the country. Okay? And so the flash message feature is not working because the email is not working. And hopefully we'll have that fixed sometime tomorrow. It's not up to us. Look, it's all the site, everything, it's all right there at the server where it's been. Okay, it's all right there. But with the domain name not working, with that not working, about 80% of that site does not work. Okay, including the email. So we're using this backup page for today. Walter, before we went away for break, you mentioned that a mentor a professional mentor, told you don't publish that book. And you said that this is a mentor that has somebody that had been in the biz for a while. What biz are we talking about? Can you hear me, Walter?
I didn't catch the question. It was
confusing. Yeah, what biz was your mentor in?
He was in, and I have to say, I'm not at liberty to discuss him too much publicly, but he was in the profession I was in, the, you know, the world of national security. Had been military before that, and for several decades.
Okay, so he told you don't publish this book because it's got some things in it that are too close to the truth.
Yes.
Okay. All right, well, that's interesting. And the reptilian saying, hey, you know, you are the alien. You humans are the aliens. And I am from this planet. I evolved from the dinosaurs. That was one of the things that was touchy for this mentor. And he said that's too close to the truth.
That was one of the many things in the book. He did not sit down and specify with me what in the novel. He just said there were way too many things in there that were much too close to the truth. The closest he came to anything that was in there was, let's say a covert space program.
Okay. Now, just one more question, and then we'll open the phone lines. Your background is in national security. You've worked for the FBI. You were not an FBI agent, but you worked for them. You have been a U.S. Air Force OSI special agent working in counterintelligence. How does someone like that get interested in all of this stuff that most of the mainstream calls edge or alternative or spooky information? How do you get interested in that from your background?
I was into these things before I started my career, and my mentor who got me started, our first conversations were on these subjects. He himself is very knowledgeable, and I will say that once I got into my career, the deeper and farther and higher I went, the deeper and higher you go in that business, the more you are prone to find people very much interested in these things. I mean, just listen to the stories of the development of SRV, scientific remote viewing, and you get the same the same revelation that these are things that are among the great secrets that are known in these organizations. Now, you have the majority of your people who don't know anything about them and aren't even interested in this kind of stuff. And, you know, they go out there and they do their jobs and they do a damn fine job, and their jobs have nothing to do with this stuff. And my jobs, the actual things I was assigned to do had nothing, to do with these things. But I learned what I know now, mostly during the years I was doing that, because I was exposed to it, I was cleared for certain things, and nothing I've said here would violate any trust I was given. So, in other words, I'm not telling you everything. But let's just say the things I've heard and became privy to generally lend to the things I believe in and do talk about.
Okay.
So,
fair enough. All right, let's open up the telephone lines and invite the audience to join us. And the way to get in touch with us with a question or a comment for Walter is to call us. Now, the telephone numbers are as follows. The main number right here in the studio is 623-444-5889. If you live in the USA or Canada, there is a toll-free number. If you can't call me on the main number without paying for long distance, then call me on the toll-free line. It is 888-223-4599. And the 623 number, the main number, 623-444-5889, will work from anywhere in the world. So some of you around the world who have Skype and you have that special account where for just a couple of pennies you can call a telephone number, use it and give us a call, 623-444-5889. The phone lines are open. Walter, there are things that you've written about in this novel that are were deemed to be too real. We've talked a little bit about this reptilian alien that's not an alien. We're going to take this telephone call, and then after this telephone call, I've got a question or two for you about that reptilian character in your novel. All right, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, it's John from Vancouver Island.
Hello, John.
Hi. Kevin, I'd like to disagree with you a little bit about whether or not an artist can create something that he hasn't seen. Mm-hmm. I don't think an artist has to necessarily see something before the artist can create it.
Everything that an artist creates is based on something that he's seen. He adds his imagination to it, yes. You cannot create what you cannot conceive, and you cannot conceive what doesn't exist.
Well, there's something called the imagination.
It's all based on something you've seen. You can't imagine something
I'm having a hard time hearing you.
Can't help it. Can't help it. You just have to listen close. Did you hang up?
So what I'm suggesting is you don't necessarily have to see something, but you do need an idea of it, and there's a difference.
Okay. You cannot conceive of something that doesn't exist. If you try to conceive of anything, if you try to imagine anything, it's based on something you have seen.
Well, I agree, but I'll give an example. I'm a big fan of Tolkien's Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
And I got really intrigued with the trolls. So right away, as soon as I decided to draw the trolls, I saw them as reptilian right away. So basically what I did was I got, you know, pictures of snakes and other reptilian types of things and just tried to combine them with the human form. And this was a number of years ago. And now when I hear about reptilians, I'm thinking, geez, that sounds like what I combined in my imagination based on the idea of trolls. So, you know, that's sort of what I'm getting at.
Okay, but we have had centuries of reptilian drawings and sculptures where a reptilian becomes bipedal. We've had centuries of that. In fact, millennia of it. It dates back 5,000 years. My question is the first one. The first one. You can't conceive of anything that does not exist. You can combine things into something that does not exist, but every bit of imagination is based on something that exists.
Okay.
Like you could conceive of a turnip that has a human nose, but that's because turnips exist and human noses exist. You cannot draw what does not exist. In any imagination, there are kernels of fact. Does that make sense?
Uh, oh, Okay, I'll just get off the line here. But I do think you're cutting imagination a bit short. That's
okay. Imagine something that does not exist and describe it for me.
Okay, Kevin.
You can't do it.
I'll get off the line here.
All right, thanks for the call. It's impossible to imagine something that does not exist. Now, you can combine, you can take pieces of things that exist and combine them in a weird way with your imagination. That's what science fiction movies are about. Okay? But you can't conceive of something that does not exist at all. If it does not exist, you can't even imagine it.
Since you brought up movies, can I share some news with your audience?
The sure.
The audience it's shared with?
Absolutely.
Pardon?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, today I talked to you. I was at the Paramount lot meeting with some producers, and I'd like to say that my novel, written under my pseudonym, Secret of the Amazon Queen, is now in development. It'll go into pre-production as a film in May, and it's coming out from My Way Pictures, and it's really, really exciting news. It's going to be a movie.
Congratulations, Walter.
Thank you. Thank you. It it'll be limited theatrical, straight to, it'll be on cable, and it'll make the rounds at some festivals, and then of course be on DVD. So and we're talking U.S. and international distribution.
It may become a cult classic. That would be a good thing. All right. The telephone number is 623-444-5889. Or toll-free, 888-223-4599. Walter, let's talk about your reptilian. How was he able to make himself look human?
You mean the one in my book?
Yes.
Well, he had actually, that was...
But I don't know. Do you have another reptilian? Have you, like, met a reptilian?
Pardon?
Have you ever met a reptilian?
No. I basically, this was because you know, I was thinking in terms of you know, what would the, I was beginning to toy around with themes of what if the human race, as we know it, we came from another world, came from Mars, for example. Mars was our, and I believe this now. Okay, we've discussed this before. I believe that we came from other worlds to here. And that's when I was beginning to toy around with those concepts back in the mid, late 80s, early 90s. And I wanted to put that in the book, and I thought that would be an interesting twist, that the, what we thought was an extraterrestrial was actually a native to Earth. And they, because their civilization was so old, they had advanced technology, and they were coming and going. But ironically, this was their home and not ours. And we had come here so far back in time that, you know, present day, we've forgotten our origin, so to speak. And he looked as human as you and I. The only difference was there was something weird about his eye color. But he explains it to my main character, a character named Dennis Nichols. And he explains it to him. He says, he goes, I'm not the alien. He goes, you're the extraterrestrial. And then they get on a flying saucer and go to Mars together, by the way, through electromagnetic lay energy, which in my novel connects all the planets. Now, this is, you know, a few years after I'd heard the string theory idea, and the way it worked in my mind, creative mind, was, well, what if the lay energy not only wraps around the planets, but connects the planets as well? And that's how the flying saucers were traveling between the worlds, is they just tap into a line and they ride that line to Mars or the moon or whatever, wherever they wanted to go. And that's how he gets to Mars. And when he gets to Mars, he finds out that the human civilization there that remained had gone underground and lived in the hollow of Mars and in tunnels, a tunnel world. And he meets them. And, of course, he learns that the face on Mars is a communications device, which he talks to his boss, who, as I told you, was standing in front of the Sphinx of Egypt and could hear him, and they could talk to each other.
You were talking about the possibility that these ley lines are not just confined to Earth, but extend out into space. And that's pretty interesting because there's an article out today where scientists have discovered that's the fact. They don't call it a ley line. They have discovered that there are all these clusters of galaxies that are moving along the same line, and they're along a line headed toward, I believe it was, I could be wrong, but I think it's headed in the direction of Alpha Centauri. And they don't know why they're all lined up. It's a brand new discovery. They're moving along a line.
If I'm hearing you correctly, because I'm hearing it kind of broken, you were saying that the scientists have discovered that there's all these clustered galaxies, clustered celestial bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And what came to my mind was the I believe it's called the Chladni Sphere. And again, Secheri and Handprint of Atlas, I'm telling you, you guys got to read this book. He talks about this in there in relation to the ley lines, about how you can vibrate a surface, and you can have dust. Let's say you put like a sand on the surface of this thing, spread it out like on a drum, and then you kind of beat it or vibrate it, and what happens is the sand begins to gather in distinct patterns. It moves across the surface and then gathers in patterns of lines, and he uses that as an example of how this energy, the Earth is this vibrating, energy thing, and this energy gathers where it intersects. It's kind of a cluster, and then of course the clusters are connected by the lines of the sand because that's where the energy is drawing it to. And I'm wondering, when you said that, I'm wondering if the universe is the macrocosm of the microcosm. Earth, with its ley line grid system, is the microcosm of the entire universe, which also has the lines running through it, and it's vibrating with energy and life, and the galaxies cluster like the sand on the sphere that's vibrating, and maybe there are thinner lines of this that connect all the galaxies and worlds together.
Well, it could be. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. All right, folks.
How interstellar travel is achieved by the flying saucers.
Could be. It could be. All right, folks, let me make this announcement. If you wish to call in, you need to do so, because in this next break, I'm going to put Walter on the other phone line that you normally use to call in. That is so he will be able to hear me better. There, for some reason, the connection between phone system A and Walter isn't working well, and phone system B and Walter works well. So we're going to put him on there. So if you're going to call, you need to call, because when we come back from the break, phone lines will be closed because Walter will be there. Walter, this reptilian, did he look reptilian but disguised himself to look human, or did he look human normally, usually?
I recall, you got to understand, I wrote this in 91, and I put it away, and I've only looked at it once, briefly, I think like maybe 8 years later,
around okay.
9, and I haven't looked at this damn thing in going on over 10 years now. My recollection is that he looked as human as you and I, and what he did was he projected a holographic kind of movie. He led the agent out to the Integratron out at Landers, for those of you familiar with the dome building that George Van Tassel built, and he took him out there and he projected it on the side of the wall, showing the agent this hidden history of the Earth and these reptilians. But he himself looked as human as you or I, but his eyes were different. His irises were more cat-like, you might say. They just weren't, the round.
Okay, let's take this phone call real quick because we're almost at the next break. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hey, it's Ray from California. Kevin, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing, Ray?
Oh, really good. You're breaking up quite a lot.
We know that, Ray. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me just give you a question or an idea I had about what you were talking about, the ley lines earlier. And what I had to pose this question is, what if the ley lines were also what the wormholes went down once they were energized? I don't know too much about that, but it kind of makes sense to me, and I wondered if you could expound on that. And with that, thank you very much, and I'll get off and let you do that.
Okay, Ray. Thanks for the call. All right. What about that, Walter? Wormholes, do they operate along the ley lines?
I didn't catch it. No, I'm sorry. Very broken up.
Did you hear the caller?
No.
All right. Well, apparently, I've got this thing cranked wide open, and it's just not working out. But so I'm going to crank it back down to normal. So here's the deal, Walter. What about wormholes? Do they operate according to the ley lines? Okay, Walter cannot hear me, and we're 20 seconds from break, so we'll release Walter from the telephone, and we'll put him on the other line. And when we come back, if you have a question or a comment, I'm so sorry you didn't have the courage to call us earlier, because the phone lines will not be available. Walter will be there. We'll be back, folks, right after this. We are back, and I want to make clear to everyone that the reason the phone lines are not open is because there's interference on the other line. Now, the other line is the one that I use for the guests all the time. We could hear Walter fine, but he couldn't hear us. And, Walter, let me ask you, can you hear me okay now?
Yeah, absolutely. You're clear.
All right. Now, here's the interesting thing, folks. I want you to think about this. So long as we had Walter on the other line, when a caller would call in, they would say, I'm having trouble hearing you. Now Walter is on the line that they were saying they were having trouble hearing me. And Walter, you're not having any trouble hearing me, right?
That's right.
Okay. So you see, it's not the equipment. There's some kind of interference out there. But it was an interference with one line that Walter was on. But when we push the button and bring a caller on, now it joins those two lines together, and they get the spillover interference. You see? All right. Walter, this whole thing about Lemuria really fascinates me. And it fascinates me because, on the one hand, I do understand that there's lore, there are legends, and you can't take everything that's in the lore and everything that's in the legends as though it were the gospel truth, because things get embellished. But when you strip away as much of the embellishment as it's possible, and you try to reduce it down to the basic information, and it's impossible to do that entirely because we don't know exactly what should be in the basic information. But when you do that, what you get is people 5,000 years ago writing about reptilian gods, drawing pictures of them, carvings of them. In Sumeria, you get them in Yugoslavia, or in that region. You get them in Central America, South America. You get them in the Indonesian cultures. You get them in the area that today is India. And then right here in the Southwest desert of the United States, the native people talk about these lizard people that came up out of the ground and showed them how to survive in the desert. Okay? So if you strip all the lore and the embellishments and the what we would consider to be wild stories away from it, you're still left with a wild story, and that is that there are intelligent reptilians. And this goes all the way back for people in Western civilization. This goes all the way back to the first book in your Bible. Because when it says the serpent spoke to Eve and you think it's a snake, you're wrong. It's not a snake. He had legs. He stood upright. And how do you know? Because your Bible says his punishment was he lost the use of his legs. His punishment was that he had to start crawling. So he was upright. And he was intelligent. He could carry on a conversation. Now, some of you might say, well, I think that's myth and legend. Okay, fair enough. But I can tell you this. The majority of the people in America think that's probably true, at least to some degree, a true story. They may not know all the details and ramifications, but they think that's a true story. Well, if you think the Bible is true, it's right there in your book.
Mm-hmm.
So this whole idea of intelligent reptilians is interesting. And Walter, here's one more thing. Of course, you know this because you've hung around me, you've hung out with me, you climbed a mountain with me, and we've talked a lot. So you know already about this. But here's something I think I need to throw in here. In Genesis, it does not tell us that reptile was from some other planet. It does tell us that the God who's doing the speaking is not from here. It does tell us the angels are not from here, but it doesn't tell us that reptile is from somewhere else. Very well could be that reptile is native to Earth.
Yes.
Therefore, the stories about a race of reptilian, upright reptilians, intelligent, living on this planet, very well could have some basis in fact. It could be. How, you said there's a lot of this stuff that you think is accurate. Where do you stand on that? How accurate are the stories about intelligent reptilians living on this planet?
Well, you've got of course, the classic story of Quetzalcoatl, whose symbol was the winged serpent, and was called the winged serpent, and he was a survivor. He came from the east to the west to the Americas on a raft. You know, the way the boat was described, it was like a raft. And, you know, when we think of a raft, we think of kind of like an inflatable emergency type boat, a survival type of vessel. And he came and his knowledge was advanced, and his awareness was advanced, and he taught the ancient cultures, you know, the agriculture and government and interesting technologies and things like that. And then he left. He went back across the sea and said he would return. Well, many see the story of Atlantis in that. That's just one story that's like this. There's many cultures that have the story of the strangers with the advanced knowledge and awareness and technology coming across the sea, teaching the locals about agriculture and all these things, and then disappearing. Saying, yeah, we'll be back someday, that kind of thing. And they're always coming across the water and going back across the water, which many researchers have tied with Atlantis, either at the time of the destruction of Atlantis. And some of the, in some stories, I must also add, they didn't leave. They stayed, and you see images of them depicted as so-called gods, and the kings of those civilizations, those native civilizations, as they grew in time, were actually supposed to be the replacement of the god and were depicted, you know, in emulation of that god. But the, sometimes that god came across the sea or out of the sea, like Oannes in ancient Sumeria, I believe. And some people see that this was the remnants, the survivors of the destruction of the Atlantean and Lemurian cultures, that they were the survivors of the cataclysm that destroyed those lands, and they came to the other lands, and they were the ones who taught all this advanced knowledge. And there, you know, in the case of Quetzalcoatl, I believe Viracocha, their symbol was this serpent with wings. And it might be that this serpent-based race were these beings who came and taught all this stuff and then disappeared, and then as new spirituality and new theologies arose, they had to be demonized. And so they were then, they then became equated with, oh, these are the devils, these are the evil ones, because, you know, you've always got to get rid of it. It's like, I don't know, it's like you just always got to get rid of the guy who was before you. You know, you always got to downplay them. It's like with the fairy culture. Now, we know fairies as sprightly little tiny figures and dwarves and gnomes, and, you know, they have wings and they fly around and they're tiny little things and ha, ha, ha. Well, the deeper you go back and the farther you go back, these were not tiny little creatures. These were men of tall and large, powerful stature, and they had amazing powers and knowledge. And basically, as their time waned and they retreated and disappeared from the known lands, and, you know, human civilization took over with the new religions, they had to be belittled. So they had to be cut down to size, as it were, and made to, you know, so that over time we were told that they were physically tiny creatures, when actually they were not. And
so you're saying that originally, if we go far enough back in the lore and mythology about the fairy people.
Yeah.
That you, as you go farther back, they actually grow in stature.
Oh, my gosh. They were as big as we were, and generally taller and larger in some cases, and very powerful and mighty. Read about the Tuatha De Danans, who disappeared into the ground, by the way. The Tuatha De Danans are one of the races that disappeared into the underground world. And, like, for instance, I believe it's, you know, you see the little gnomes in their red cone hats.
Mm-hmm.
And we see them as happy little garden guys around Travelocity commercial, and they're just happy little guys like in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Well, not so fast. Those guys didn't start out being tiny. They were, you know, just as large as we were, and, you know, their hats start out white, but they're into certain type magic and knowledge, and the hats, and this is a fact in the lore, their hats turn red because they drink the menstrual blood of virgins from their hats, and that's what turns the hats red.
Do you think Travelocity is aware of this?
I don't think so. There's a whole bunch of children's books that are not aware of that either, but that is the fact of the lore. Think about that one next time you go to Disneyland.
All right, now
talk about it in Latitude 33.
Which, by the way, folks, if you haven't gotten Latitude 33, Key to the Kingdom, it is in ebook format and available on our website when the website is back up, and you'll be able to purchase it then.
And I'm supposed to be speaking on it at the Mount Hood Paranormal Conference in Mount Hood, Oregon, on April 25th.
There you go. Yep. All right, I want to go back to your novel.
Yes.
Because although it's never been published, we've talked about it several times here on the show. This is the first time we've talked about this reptilian. And he tells he tells the guy that's his shadow that's following him, surveilling him. He tells him, look, I'm not the extraterrestrial. You are. And you said that you have reached a point where you think that's probably true. Why do you think that is the case? Why do you think that we are extraterrestrials?
I have, through my studies, begun to accept the idea that, for instance, we are talking about the Bible. I believe it's very possible that the Garden of Eden, one of two things here, it was either on another planet, and the story of us being banished was when we had to leave that world and come to this one. And the reason we, in our story, it's a Garden of Eden, God's own garden, is it's kind of nostalgia, for our old home. And when we had to come here, this was a rugged surface, rough surface world. We had to build a new civilization. So there's the part of the story of Genesis where you're banished out of the Garden of Eden and, you're banished to a life of work, work, work. Well, think about it, if our homeland is, our homeland, it gets destroyed, say like in Battlestar Galactica, and you find the new home, and you've got to rebuild, you've got to start anew. That's work, 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 work. It totally fits.
All right, we have to step away for a break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Let me remind you that the phone lines are not open because of the difficulty Walter was having with the line we had him on. So we've put him on the line that you normally call in on. Those of you who took the opportunity while they were open, thank you for the calls. Walter, let's talk about, we were talking about, why you think that we are the extraterrestrials. Let's talk about how we got here. Let's say something happened and we were forced to leave whatever planet we were on. First, what planet do you think we were on? Second, how did we get here?
I believe the last human habitation for us was the surface of Mars. I believe when whatever happened to Mars decimated its surface, that's what forced many of us to come here. Many went underground. I personally believe there's a human civilization under the surface on Mars, but many of them came here.
How?
To Earth and in ships, craft. I mean, there was advanced technology. Just like we have spaceships and craft, we built them then. You got to understand, I believe that it is, and I'm going to use a phrase here that's just going to rankle some people, and I don't care, but I believe that it is manifest human destiny that we have, we do, and we will and should continue to traverse the worlds. We are a nomadic race of beings. We started on other worlds. We were on Mars. We were on a world before Mars, before we went to Mars, different worlds. I believe there's more of us on other worlds, and we've moved from world to world. We happen to be, our contingent happens to be on Earth and has been for however many, millions of years. And when this planet is running low on energy and resources, it's time to go. I believe the resources of the worlds are there to sustain us, and when they do run out, we go to the next world. Now, I'm not saying we trash the planet. I'm saying we use the planet. And when those resources can no longer sustain us in great numbers, then many of us go on to another world that can. I do believe that this is the way of the human being, and it is our destiny. And we should do this. I don't think it's evil. I think there's a bunch of us that, they're very touched and heartwarmed over the little critters and the trees and stuff like that. I'm not saying we should trash those things or treat them like crap, but we're revering these things a little too much. And I think it's patently ridiculous to put us beneath all these things. We, we'll be here for a while, then we'll move on. I don't believe in the premise of Avatar. I think that's just a bunch of politics of that particular individual, and good for him.
It was a good movie, though.
But
Oh, great. Yeah. And good thing, let's keep that stuff in movies, because it's more damaging to human civilization and the human spirit than things like the potentials of commerce and exploration. You know, I hear a guy on TV yesterday or this morning, he's just all smiles. Hey, the future of human exploration in space are robots. Screw that. Boots on the ground. I'm sorry, I feel strong about this. Boots on the ground. I'll tell you what boots on the ground will do. It'll give us a new industry. It'll give us a new frontier. It will help our industries. It'll give us vision and dream enough to make physical, practical things happen. We will build new worlds with new industries, and we'll have relief from the doldrum that the particular philosophy of socialism and humanism, you know, does.
Well, Walter, the fact is we're going out of the astronaut business.
We shouldn't.
But it's been decided. The president has said it. The NASA master, whatever they call him, the administrator, has agreed with it. And the astronaut business is over for us, unless we can hitchhike with the Russians.
No. That's temporary. That president, he will eventually get out of office. That NASA administrator will be replaced and by people. I guarantee you, I can't tell you how soon, but I guarantee you these individuals will be replaced by those with vision, greater vision.
Well, you know, here's the problem, though.
Boots on the ground on other world.
All right, let's say you are Boeing, and you have a big chunk of this contract to build the Constellation spacecraft. It's the Constellation program. So you got a big chunk of that. Mm-hmm. All right, now they're canceling all of that. The next time they get ready to go into space, first of all, it may be 20 years from now. You don't know. It may be. So 20 years from now, they're ready to go. Well, because of the fact that we have canceled all of that, two things have taken place. One, the willingness of Boeing to get back into it and maybe get canceled again is probably going to be a little bit less than enthusiastic. Secondly, and I'm just using Boeing. I mean, there's thousands of companies involved in this. Secondly, all the time that we've been not going into space, we've been losing the brain power to do so.
That's right. We've been
losing the technology to do so. We're not building it.
That's right.
There are no jobs for people to train in college for in that industry. And so you're starting from ground zero when you decide to start becoming spacefaring again.
And the reason for that is, I'm telling you right now, the one pure reason, there's only one reason for this happening, and that goes down a road you don't like to go to on this show, and that's, I'll just use the one word, it's political. Okay? The only reason Americans aren't going into space is purely political.
Well, of course politics enters into it because they hold the purse strings for NASA.
Mm-hmm.
And look, you've heard me say it. You've heard me say it right here on this show. $18 billion a year for NASA to explore the universe? What is that, a joke? That's a joke. And it's not even a good joke. And you've got almost $1 trillion for companies like AIG and for the banks and for GM, and you know, you've got all that and money left over sitting there right now, and they're fussing about how to spend it. You mean you can't get another $18 billion out of that nearly $1 trillion? Pull $18 billion and just double NASA's budget and tell them, look, get on with this.
Right, and start putting people in NASA that want to put people in space. Let's get the old type NASA guys back. These people that have been pushing the robot thing, this is not good. for us, and if it's not good for the world, it's not good for human civilization.
Well, I don't think that we need to exclude the robots. I mean, look what Spirit and Opportunity have done.
Of course, it's used the robots, but let's follow it up with people. Now, you said for every Boeing that would balk at getting involved,
mm-hmm.
I guarantee you there's two or three, maybe five, that'll say, we'll do it, we'll do it. See, we need to open up space to commerce. Ooh, the big evil capitalism. But I'll tell you right now, the best way to get boots on the ground on other planets and people out there is to open it up to commerce. You open it up to commerce, and let me tell you, these companies will be sending people up there. Will accidents happen? You damn right they will. Will people get killed on other worlds? You're darn right. You know what? The future is not for the faint of heart. Where have we heard that before? And, you know, if you can't handle it, stay home.
Okay. Well, now see, the deal is the president is saying that NASA is going to get out of the astronaut business, but industry is in. We have reached the end of the show. I wish we had more time. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Hope to see you in Tucson on Saturday, and I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, so long, everybody.